Hello, good evening, everybody. Thank you for waiting. I'm delighted to have Joseph Scott Morgan with us, and he's a distinguished scholar of applied forensics, former coroner's investigator, must have some really harrowing stories there, and host of the podcast Body Bags with Joseph Scott Morgan. And tonight we're going to be focusing on Epstein and Charlie Kirk, what's really going on? So, huge thank you for coming on because they are two subjects our viewers are really engaged with.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Sean. It's such a great pleasure to be with you. And I love all of my friends in Great Britain. We come over a couple of times a year, actually. So I was just over this past September for I think September. No, it was earlier than that. We were back twice this past year for CrimeCon UK, and we've come over. I've spoken in Bath before at the Center for Death Studies, one of the few in the world, and we enjoy our time there. Always do. The people are always so lovely to us and kind, and just enjoy traveling all about the nation.
Well, next time you're speaking in Bath, let us know. You can stay at our house. We live on the outskirts of Bath.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, I would love to. Yeah, lovely, lovely, lovely place. I don't think I realized how can I put this? I don't want to use the term elite, but we had come from London and we didn't have much dough at the time. The first time we went over, and we stayed in some, kind of more sketchy areas of London, and we took the train over to Bath, and we're like, holy smokes, I don't think they'll let us remain here. They're going to kick us out. But it was beautiful. The cathedral, the church is mind blowing, particularly up in the rafters. You go up and see the bells and everything up there. Beautiful, beautiful place.
Yeah, the Roman history is
Yeah.
incredible.
Oh,
But
yeah.
let me find out what got you into the Epstein subject in the first place.
Well, for a number of reasons, I was intrigued by it because my background is I started out as in the US, we have what are referred to as medical legal death investigators. And in the UK, you guys have the coroner system or the coroner service there. It's a bit different over here in the US. We still have coroners here, but I started my career in New Orleans with the coroner's office in Jefferson Parish, Louisiana, and worked there as a coroner investigator and also in the autopsy room. And then I became the senior investigator with the medical examiner, which is kind of along the same lines as a coroner, in Atlanta, where I was a senior investigator for about 14 years. And I'd worked a number of cases in correctional facilities over my time, and primarily local jails and that sort of thing. Hangings, natural deaths, had a couple of homicides. And something just didn't sit right with me, particularly given the idea that someone had just been, that someone being Epstein had been on suicide watch. And most of the time, when you have cases like that, the staff are particularly cued in to what's going on with an individual. And it struck me as odd that he would suddenly die like this. And obviously they've ruled that he died at his own hand, right? And then I began to hear a smattering of reports relative to some of the circumstances. And this is all the way back in, I think, 19. And then I was a guest on CNN. They asked me about it, and I kind of told them the difference between a soft hanging and a suspended hanging. And they were saying it was a soft hanging. And then I know Michael Bodden pretty well, and he was the consulting forensic pathologist on the behalf of, I think, Mark Epstein, Epstein's brother, that was in attendance at the autopsy. When I heard what Dr. Bodden said, and then I saw some of the imagery, I'm thinking this is just completely inaccurate. And Dr. Bodden is held in high esteem over here. He's pretty much worldwide as well. And the findings just didn't marry up with what they were physically saying about this. And it was as my friends in Great Britain say, I was gobsmacked over this whole matter. Things just didn't add up.
So the fractures of the hyoid, he said, were more indicative of him not doing it to himself. And do you concur with that?
Yes. The hyoid is, for folks that don't know, the hyoid is a curious little bone. It's the only non-articulating bone in the human body, and it sits very, very high up in our neck. And even with judicial hangings that we've had in the past, that you guys have had in the past, there's a fantastic book that was written by, I think family's last name is Pierpoint, and they were the executioners to the Queen back during the time. And they hung a variety of Nazi criminals. Gentlemen would fly back and forth, shuttle back and forth from London during that period of time. And he made quite wonderful notes about procedurally. And we knew this already. You just don't see, and in the morgue I'd observed it, you just don't see fractured hyoids in hangings. And certainly not in what are referred to as soft hangings, where an individual will take a ligature, tie it off, and then just kind of slump into it and kind of sit down. It's not like there's a huge drop, where you think classically, you watch a movie, of a hanging and the snapping of the neck and all that sort of thing. It doesn't work. And then the ME, Dr. Sampson, I think, had stated that, well, his hyoid was particularly ossified with age. Again, really wouldn't buy it. But what's more intriguing than that is that inferior to the hyoid, he had two cartilaginous fractures as well, which were kind of in the vertical plane, and they were inferior to the hyoid fracture, which is way, way up in the neck. And that quite struck me as well. So these, in at least in my opinion, and I think probably, and I don't want to speak for Dr. Bodden, but it would seem as though he felt the same. In addition to that, that these seem to be two separate events traumatically. Okay. So that's the reason I think that if you look to the science in this case, it's somewhat of a head scratcher.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely fascinating, because I was aware of the one, but not the higher up one.
Yeah.
So what kind of pressure will be required to do both of those if they were separate?
Well, here's a really intriguing part about this is that these images are all about the internet. There's one that demonstrates ligature marks, which for those that don't know, ligature marks are those marks, and they're kind of abraded areas where, if you think about the skin being rubbed, that are inferior. They're around this range. And there's not one, but there's two. And those are external manifestations that you see. They're kind of lopped on top of one another. It's almost like there was a readjustment of a ligature. And here's the really fascinating part, not that the rest of it isn't fascinating, is that when we talk about hangings, we talk about something that's referred to as tinting feature. And tinting feature is not T-I-N-T-I-N-G. I mean, T-I-N-T-I-N-G, like the tint of your window. It's like a pup tint, T-E-N-T-I-N-G. So if you say, I think I've got a little cord right here. So if you think about a tinting feature where it's like, let's say this is the neck. Okay. Right here, my finger, it goes up and there's an apex in the ligature at the top, like in a noose. Okay. It creates a furrow that goes behind the ears and goes up. It's what you normally see with hangings. Epstein's ligature features went straight back. They go parallel to the shoulders. Listen, don't believe anything I'm saying. look at it yourself. Okay. It kind of defies science. If you think about, what position would he have had to have been in order to facilitate that kind of insult to the neck, he would almost have to be face down, on the floor in a soft hanging. And that is certainly atypical. It's something I've never borne witness to over my years, and none of my colleagues I've ever spoken to. That's what makes this so scientifically intriguing, I think, for all of us.
So, you know, you talked about Mark Epstein. We interviewed him. I'm going to put it in the live chat for the viewers, and I'll also put it in the description box if you're watching on replay. And Epstein's brother Mark, you know, did say a lot, basically what you said as well. He concurs that he didn't do it to himself. All right, so that's what got you intrigued. I was writing about the war on drugs, and I came across Southern Air Transport, Air America, these CIA airlines brought into Ohio by Wexner and Epstein. That's what brought me into the world. But then I started to go deeper and deeper from there. So where did you go next once these anomalies had come to your attention?
Where did I go? There's nowhere I can really go next. I mean, I'm a college professor. You know, I've spoken about it certainly in my classes. I've spoken about it extensively on the news with, you know, anyone that would ask the question. I mean, you know, because I look at it not from a political perspective, but, you know, first off, it's this sounds horribly morbid. Please forgive me in advance. It's an excellent teaching tool for me. I mean, I teach a medical legal death investigation class at university. I created it 20 years ago. And one of the specific things, areas that I cover is asphyxial death. And it's a beautiful demonstration, you know, of what we're compare and contrast, you know, of what we're seeing here. Just simply scientifically, and whether or not, you know, people, I think out around the world would choose to believe it or not. It certainly depends, I think, upon where you're coming from. I would hope that people would be open to the idea that maybe there is another answer to this. He's got some other injuries as well, including contusions on his arms. His right trapezius area here, behind his neck. He's got a contusion, kind of a circular, almost the size of a shilling, right here on the back. That's not something that's like what we refer to as a focal area of hemorrhage that would have to be specifically struck. And listen, if somebody is bumping into a wall, right? I think that we could all appreciate, you know, bumping and, you know, sustaining a contusion bruise, you know, on the surface of our arm or on our thigh or wherever that might be. But how do you wind up with a contusion right here? And I'm not going to say there's a definitive pattern, but there's kind of a shape, you know, that's there. And it's just a matter of trying to look at that and try to explain it and connect it with his death and see if it's related. You know, I think some of these contusions that he has, these insults to his body, what were their ages, right? Because, you know, like in abuse cases where we're looking at child abuse cases, unfortunately, or elder abuse cases, spousal abuse cases that have ended in someone's demise, we age, it's called aging of bruises. So at autopsy, we will examine those bruises to see at what status of resolve is. And we can all relate to this because if you bump into something, you suddenly get this kind of red presentation, then it goes to kind of a blue, black. And then as it resolves, it changes, you know, you'll go to a green and then that disgusting yellow color. And then it dissipates, it's gone, you know, at that point in time. So that's something that's intriguing as well. Plus, he had petechiae in his, you know, in his eyes, I believe, you know, which is consistent with an asphyxial death. That means the little vessels in his eyes, you know, burst. He's cyanotic, you know, like a light shade of an eggplant, you know, from the neckline up again, is consistent with an asphyxial death.
So, were you aware of the altercation he allegedly had with his prior cellmate, Nicholas?
Yeah, I've heard about this.
And could any of the injuries that you're describing, Could you predate them to that altercation?
Well, I think that perhaps the forensic pathologist that was involved in the case at the time, that is the official what's referred to as the certifier of death, could. That certainly falls well within the parameters of their expertise and their training and their experience. Yeah.
So Jean-Luc Brunel, he suffered the same fate, but in French prison. Was any information released about his injuries? Because he was the second in command procurer after Maxwell.
I've heard of this name and people have mentioned, but to this point, again, please forgive me. I have not reviewed any of the data from his case. I'd be more than happy to review it and you know, give my views on it.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if the French, they did away with him so swiftly. I'd be surprised if they released any autopsy stuff. All right, so we've got a viewer question here. Was the body 100% identified to be Epstein's?
Well, yeah. I would imagine that verification would lay at the feet of the corrections mm-hmm. personnel, because they are charged, as you know, Sean, they're charged mm-hmm. with specific identity, right? You know, there's any number of ways that people in the correction system are in fact identified. And then again, you've got this, which again, this is kind of a fascinating piece to all of this. I don't want to, continue down this road over and over. I hope you don't tire of it. But the idea that Dr. Bodden was there, he's an independent observer here. He's not employed by the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner of the City of New York. He's no longer the state medical examiner for New York. He is solely employed by Mark Epstein as his representative there. You know, I think that he would probably have mentioned that to Mark if he felt as though that this was not in fact his brother's body. Now how Dr. Bodden would verify that, he would be relying upon the data that was coming to him from OCME.
All right, got a few more of your questions have come in. Sure. So this person wants to know if you think that he could have set up a rig that enabled him to do a front roll off the bunk and his own body weight would tighten the noose, causing one of his arms to damage the neck bones.
You know, that is an interesting question. One of the things that I've had several people ask me over a period of time for good reason is that there is a specific height. If I referred to the Pierpoint book earlier, there is a specific height that people have to fall from and a specific weight that equates to the velocity and the amount of velocity it would take in order to, well, in judicial hangings, to break the neck. Okay. You know, I got to looking at the bunk itself and I'm thinking, I don't think you could generate, regardless of positionality of the body, I don't think that you could generate enough velocity in order to specifically traumatize the neck to this degree. And also given the types of ligatures that are there, we're talking about the squalid environment that he was living in. You know, you see the condition of the cell. And I was amazed by that they would allow him to live under these conditions, particularly with prescription meds. Inside of this, the fact that the mattress is pulled off the top of the bed, he's got prescription meds on the top rack, you know, where that mattress should have been dwelled. There's a CPAP machine in there that has a cord. I've often wondered that did they actually take all of those items out of there? Were they ever preserved to check for DNA? Particularly on the surfaces of the fashioned ligature that he had made out of the strips of cloth, as well as the cord on the CPAP machine, a lot of these various items in there. But, you know, here's the thing about it, Sean, is that one of the things that we do in my field is that our working premise is that every death is a homicide until proven otherwise. And I don't care if it's an 80-year-old granny that passes away at home in a hospital bed. Okay. I don't know this person, period, end of paragraph. I walk in, my assumption is always going to be that they have died at the hands of another until I can prove otherwise scientifically, you know, and you kind of start at the peak of that pyramid and work your way down. Much like a case that's been covered to great extent in America right now with the Ellen Greenberg case. The idea that officials would go into a room and just, you know, say, oh, this is a suicide, and they're not going to pursue it any further. Well, what does that do? Well, first off, it predisposes you to a particular intellectual track, you know, as you're moving forward with the case. And then those things that would be held with great care and be treated as precious as far as evidence goes, they're dismissed. You don't have the evidence continuity at that point in time. So if you go into an environment, you say, yeah, this is, someone took their own life. This has no value. Let's go ahead and get rid of it. We're not going to examine it on any level. It's a real train wreck, you know, when you think about that.
All right. You've got Richard wants to know if the ligature marks could have been caused by someone standing in front of him and holding his arms while someone stood behind with a cord around his neck with his knee on the trapezoid.
That, Richard, is a fantastic question because this contusion that you see on the shoulder here is very, very specific. Would it be consistent with the size of a man's knee? Perhaps, you know, depending upon the position of the knee. And yes, that injury perhaps could be those injuries with the, you know, these ligature marks running parallel to the shoulders. Yeah, that could give you an indication that there may have been a pullback on this. That's why, you know, earlier on when we were chatting, you know, I was talking about how, you know, you think about a soft hanging with him lying face down. That would seem to me the only way that you could achieve these markings on the neck.
So Simon wants to know, what do you think most likely happened?
What do I think most likely happened? Simon. Let's see. Well, I can tell you what I don't think happened. I don't think that the insults that he sustained internally, okay, the structures of the neck, I don't think that was generated by a soft hanging. Put it to you that way. I don't think that the marks, which there are a couple of them, were generated by a soft hanging. I can tell you what, I can at least say that. I know that. Now, did anyone have access to him? Well, that's the great mystery, isn't it? You know, particularly when people are putting out videography of gaps in time and these sorts of things with CCTV, blind spots and all these sorts of things, and the mystery image, you know. And, I don't know about you, Sean, in this world that we live in right now, I don't really know how much credence I assign to, I hate to sound this way, to any kind of videography, you know, I kind of see. But it would seem to me that it looks legit and that there's a time gap there. And again, that's not really my bailiwick. I don't dance in that area, but, you know, I've been on these programs and there are other people that will comment on it. And, you know, so a lot of this is going to be, could you have two individuals that, and this is going to Simon's earlier question, could two individuals have accomplished this, or could one person do this to him that could have access to him? Another piece to this is that his tox screen was clear from what, if I'm remembering correctly as well. So how thoroughly was the tox screen done? I would imagine it's a standard panel. With standard panels in the US, it's the same way in the UK. When we do a tox screen where we draw blood, urine, vitreous from the eye, bile from the gallbladder, you know, we'll look for things like opiates, any kind of designer drugs, pretty much those that we can, THC, cocaine metabolite, meth, you know, a whole variety of things. Is that what you're looking for here? Well, what were his chemistries relative to these medications that he was supposed to be taking? And because to date, and I might very well be wrong, I don't necessarily know specifically what meds he had been prescribed, who prescribed them, and what the dosages were at any single time. And here's another fascinating bit to this is that you think about the how medications in correctional facilities are generally handed out. In my experience, when I would work cases, I would talk to the nurse many times that was in charge of a particular unit or a pod. And, you know, there's a specific time where if you're on meds, you either go to the nurse and they hand you meds, you know, or if you're in a lockdown situation, there's a medical cart that comes by generally with a trustee and maybe a nurse or a technician, and they're going to give you the little paper cup and it's going to come through the door. And many times they'll try to visualize you taking the meds at that point in time. I thought, wow, gee, you know, he has access to what you can see clearly in the images. And this was on the 60 Minutes piece. You can see this, that was done, you know, below these many years ago now. You can actually see these meds distributed, Sean, on the top of this rack up there. It was really mind-boggling. One other thing too, you're talking about, and I failed to mention this, you're talking about a guy that has allegedly been suicidal. Not only were there multiple ways to create ligatures in this environment, but he had a plastic bag in there with him as well. You know, when we have wee little ones at home, what do they tell us about our kids? You know, even with babies, you're not supposed to have plastic bags and cribs or anywhere that kids can get access to them. You're talking about a suicidal guy, and you let him have. And let me tell you where you can see this image. If you're looking straight on at the bunk bed, at the top rack, look on the left-hand side, and you'll see a fully inflated, it's filled with air, plastic bag up there. Well, I've worked multiple cases over the course of my career with people that did this to themselves with a plastic bag. And it goes back years to I don't know if people will remember this, but there was a book famously written many years ago called Final Exit. And it's, they refer to themselves as, you know, self-deliverance. And this is one of the ways they prescribe doing this, you know, taking like a sleep medication. And I'm not going to go through all of the details. It's very gruesome and it's not healthy, but the fact that this was there, it's a perfect storm where you've got a group of people who are supposed to be in charge of him. Obviously, I don't know. I'd argue probably the single most high profile person in custody at that particular time in the U.S. And they did not take due care. Then you've got an environment where this guy is just, apparently, forgive my words, but had his ass kicked, you know, just within a very short period of time earlier. And they're not watching over him. Again, here's the problem with bureaucracy like this. If you do not take due care, then the whole thing can come off the rails very, very quickly.
Indeed, you covered a lot of ground there. And, you know, from my own experience, I saw the med nurse come just as you described, you know, guys doing the Thorazine shuffle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then once the med nurse left the building, they're all yelling out pills for sale, trying to trade off what they pretended to swallow. And there's a huge black market for these substances. And if you've got resources, you can get your hands on anything. All right. So Susan wants to know if you think that the injuries correlated more by human hands or by a ligature?
Let's say a ligature in the hands of a human.
Okay.
I'm being kind of cheeky there, but yeah, you know, you know, that's the idea, right? In order to facilitate these kind of injuries, I think one of the more troubling aspects to this is how quickly, from a forensic pathology standpoint, how quickly they got off of this case. You know, considering, I got to tell you, if it were me, I would want as many eyes on this case as possible in the autopsy suite. I'm very grateful. Well, not grateful. I'm professionally satisfied that Michael Bodden was there as an independent observer. I think that I would have preferred to have seen probably three or four more pair of eyes there that are board certified forensic pathologists that were physically there. I would want investigators there that represent not just the federal government, but also the city authorities where this took place. And this is a federal event. They have custody over him. And if there is a homicide in a federal facility, you know, the feds are going to work it. But, you know, when you can shed that much light, there's not a lot of room for shadow, right? And so if you've got multiple eyes on it and those things that you do, you get one shot at it. And it's so amazing that people are not fully aware of that. Many times, you know, in America, we've not learned our lessons, I think, very well. And again, you know, I go back to all the way back to 63 with Kennedy, because the president's body was removed from a place where you had a board certified forensic pathologist and flown all the way across the U.S. and placed into the hands of probably two of the most inept people that could have possibly chosen to do an autopsy on our commander in chief, that had never done a forensic autopsy. And there should have been, you know, a whole gaggle of forensic pathologists present for that. And I prefer that, you know, honesty is always going to win out. And the problem is when it doesn't win out in the beginning, it's a lot more painful when the truth does eventually come out, you know, because it opens wounds and those sorts of things. So I don't know. I understand what they were doing by letting Dr. Bodden in, and I'm appreciative that they did. I wish that they had taken more time with it, because some of these injuries, I think that they still need a bit more explaining to the satisfaction of a lot of people.
Well, thank you for all your viewer questions coming in. We'll get to as many of them as possible. There's over 2,000 watching live presently. So please support Joseph Scott Morgan on his socials. I'm putting the links in the live chat. If you're watching on replay, they are in the description box. All right. So next question is, which one should I choose? Oh, yeah. All right. This one. Why did MCC release pictures of Epstein's corpse on a gurney being transported to an ambulance? Would the jail have allowed photos from the media?
Interesting. I can't speak to what their policy would have been. I'm glad that I got to see some images, you know, at that point in time, because you're not going to get to see a peek inside of the autopsy room. That's for sure. And I think that that's led to a lot of speculation on the part of many folks. If it were me, just from a professional standpoint, I have no desire in my life to see, from a purely salacious standpoint, you know, blood and guts or anything like that. But from a professional standpoint and trying to understand injuries, I would welcome an opportunity to see the dissection. I think that many people would. Yeah, excellent question. But I can't speak to their procedures.
Yeah, I mean, from my own experience, which was Arizona State, it wasn't the federal. I mean, jails and prisons are extremely secretive places where they don't want the media getting involved in anything that they're doing. So, you know, for photos to have been taken like that, if there's opportunistic journalists just hanging out.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Because there's high profile prisoners in there. I could see it happening that way, but it wouldn't be something that I would see the jail encouraging, because they're really sensitive about these things.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. So, Brightmore also wants to know why Biden was brought in, JFK, why he keeps reoccurring in all these big cases, Epstein, George Floyd, JFK. Any thoughts on that?
Why does it keep reoccurring? Our own hubris? I don't know. I wrote a memoir many years ago. I wrote a memoir many years ago, and I entitled one of the chapters "Little Gods and Chocolate Milkshakes," and it had to do with my relationship with forensic pathologists. And one of the things about all physicians that you learn pretty quickly is that they do, in fact, think that they're gods, and they have the answers to all questions, and they have the answers to many questions. But low be unto that man that comes in and questions their authority. And so, when you have a little fiefdom, in your environment, you're going to make the call. You're going to make the decision. With George Floyd in particular, that's a fascinating case. I covered it for several days on air. And what was really interesting is that the pathologist that initially did the autopsy on George Floyd rendered his specific opinion. And then I'd never seen this done before. They brought in two former forensic pathologists, also on behalf of the state, to offer testimony after the testimony had been offered by the person that was currently employed as the chief medical examiner, I believe, in Minneapolis. One of the individuals was a former chief medical examiner. Very curious case. And then the defense, of course, did not present a forensic pathologist, which was kind of a head scratcher in that case. I don't know if they couldn't come up with the coin in order to be able to do that or not, because these people are very expensive. So I don't know what happened in that case. You want as many eyes on a case as you can possibly have, right? Again, I go back to that, and I will continue to go back to that. And not just eyes. You don't want people there simply for a horror show. You want people there that are keen to make legitimate scientific observations, and that can do it in an unbiased manner. And the world that we live in is in such a swirl politically objectivity, many times scientific objectivity, is very hard to find. And that's something that we desire. In our world, in the medical examiner world, in court, I have no skin in the game relative to a prosecution or a defense. We aim to present scientific truth and those truths that we've discovered. And you have to be aware of that. How well will this truth be accepted? Well, the more eyes, the more scientists you can have on a bit of data that you're analyzing, I think the healthier it is all the way around.
So what would have happened if his death had been ruled a homicide?
Wow. I think that you would have seen people scurrying a little bit and probably you would have had many of these employees who worked at the facility. You would have had more feet held to the fire, because, the classic definition of homicides, and I love the term homicide as opposed to murder. Murder is such a theatrical attorney's word. Murder most foul, that sort of thing. Homicide is very clinical. It's death at the hand of another, just like suicide is death at one's own hand. It's very cut, dried, straight to the point. So if this had been ruled a homicide, who is the other, right? Who is it that brought about his death? Was it an employee at the jail? And I'm just merely saying this, if it had been ruled as a homicide, was it an employee of the jail? Was it an inmate at the jail, or was it some phantom that slipped in through an air vent? I have no idea, but that would have triggered a very widespread investigation at that point in time. I mean, all kinds of switches would have been flipped at that time, and this intense light would have been put on this case. But as we know, they didn't go down that road.
A few people are asking whether they scraped under his nails.
Hopefully they did. I can't answer that question. And if they did, this is what would have happened. In any kind of assault case that we have that rolls into the morgue, we do two things. Well, there's several things, actually. We do hair pluckings. And lots of times that deals with sexual assault. from various areas of the body. We do hair combings. And you've heard the term fine tooth comb before. If you think about a lice infestation, that's a fine tooth comb. We actually use those in the morgue. We do nail scrapings, and anybody that cleans their nails, particularly if you're going to have a, if you've had a manicure and they use the little wooden scraper that, that you see, for years and years, when I first started, that's the type of nail scraping that you do. You scrape the nails, then you have, trimmers. There's a nail trimmer that comes with each kit, and you literally clip or trim the nails and they fall into a piece of paper. They're folded over and then that is sent off. And what you're looking for in there is, obviously, skin, from, another party, also blood. If there's also any underlying tissue other than just dead skin cells. And wouldn't that be fascinating if they had done that and they retained it and you just can put that into a database now, which we're seeing extensively now in IgG with investigative genetic genealogy. And you could say, well, I can't say that this person did it, but their skin cells were beneath this individual's fingernails. Was that done? Was it retained, or was it examined? I think is the real pressing question.
Hamilton wants to know who would have the standing to reopen the case. It's not going to be Trump and Bundy and them, is it? Because they're like, nothing to see here. Move on now.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the biggest disappointments. I think a lot of people felt as though that there was going to be a lot revealed. I don't know if there's going to be more revealed. I have no way of knowing that. But yeah, I think that that would probably, well, from beginning to end, this begins and ends with the Justice Department of the U.S. This is a federal facility. All right. They are Lord and master in this environment. This is not going to revert to the state. I can't imagine how it would. This is going to be the feds all the way. So do they have an appetite for it? Do they have an appetite for it and the intestinal fortitude to do it, I think, is one of the big questions.
Epstein was supposedly cremated. Would they have retained biosamples from the autopsy?
Yeah, they would have drawn blood, urine, vitreous, maybe bile. There are every major organ system in his body would have been retained. And when I say that, I'm talking about everything from brain, heart, liver, pancreas, spleen, intestine. They would have even taken bone samples from his spine. That's kind of standard fare. For what we do. Also, every now and then we'll take muscle tissue as well. So you would have all of those on board. They'll be retained for a specific amount of time, and it all depends on the department as to when they purge those samples, you know, to make room for more, perhaps.
So they'll be purged when they release Maxwell early. Jesse wants to know, what information at this point would satisfy any of us on this topic? Seriously, what should we look for?
I don't know that there is going to be more that will be said or stated about his death, unless, you know, as we say in the Deep South over here, unless somebody has a sudden come to Jesus moment, you know, that was involved in staff there. But those would be, let's say that somebody did have this epiphanal moment. That's dangerous waters to be treading in. No. I mean, someone would truly have to have intestinal fortitude in order to fortify themselves to that point. I think that that's really the only way that his death is going to be, reinvestigated, perhaps. I don't know. I know that there have been a lot of people in the media, on both sides of the aisle, that have been pushing for it. And you don't know how much of that is, are they legitimately concerned or are they just trying to get clicks, you know? And I'm not just saying that to the everyday people that are out in social media world. That applies to the big ones as well, okay? Because they want clicks as well. Let's not shade this in any way, all right? So who is actually vested in this? Who's going to legitimately, you know, start flipping over stones to do a deeper dive? Here's one thing that has always fascinated me about Epstein, and I'm not going to go too far afield with this, and I promise I won't. We recently had this release of this book by this young woman who passed.
Virginia.
Virginia. And
I've just almost finished reading it.
I have yet to have an opportunity to read it. And this is rather grotesque, and forgive me, but you know, there was one part of the book that was read aloud, and she talked about this in the book, this act that she was forced to be involved with these other girls, because they're not women, involving some prominent individual, an orgy, if you will. And I've often wondered about all those girls, the ones that were brought in, because, you know, many of those young women, as we've heard, or some of them at least, were from Eastern Europe. How did they make it in to the U.S., U.S. Virgin Islands, maybe New York, New Mexico, all these other locations, and what became of them? And I know that there was, you know, somebody had to sign an NDA. I've heard all of that, but is that all of them? And what happened? I mean, what do you do? Do you sexually abuse and use somebody, and then you turn them loose on the streets? They can't speak a lick of English, and they're wandering about Manhattan, or they're out in rural New Mexico. What became of all? Because we're not just talking about, if we are to believe the numbers, it's not just a small little clutch, okay? It's a vast number, and it's a vast number in the sense that that you've got multiple men being serviced here. Well, what became of them all? Did they place them back on planes and fly them all to their points of origin, you know, back in Eastern Europe, and drop them off and say, God bless, good luck? I don't know. I've often wondered about what became of those young girls.
Yeah, so viewers, Joseph is referring to the third allegation against Prince Andrew, which happened on the island. And Virginia said that the girls appeared underage. They spoke East European, they didn't speak English, and they were cracking jokes, the predators, saying that these were the easiest ones to do these things to, because they didn't speak any English. Virginia also alleged about 12-year-old triplets, jokes being made about their oral capabilities by Epstein, who was giving them as a birthday gift. And, you know, some of these girls were fast-tracked in through the Jean-Luc Brunel pipeline to the premises in the U.S. By the U.S. federal government. They had visas bringing them in as models, etc. I imagine that once these girls had just been used and abused, or they'd reached a certain age where these guys were no longer interested in them, they were discarded somehow or sent back home. I'm not sure. Perhaps a few of them were incorporated as recruiters and stuff like that. We know that happened to some of the girls as well. But yeah, because people are wondering, will these girls ever speak out? Probably not. If they were sent back home, they're terrified of these wealthy people and all these people getting unalived around the case. But it's you know, interesting to think about that, especially with the triplets. Imagine if the triplets came forth and gave their testimony. But with Virginia, you know, not being with us anymore, survivors must be even more terrified. Yeah. And if you read the book as well, she describes what they're going through: chases, people following around, her husband's doing mad car racing turns on the roads, and her husband's begging her. He's saying, maybe you should put your family ahead of this activism, because this is just out of control. So that's, and then the amount of survivors that are believed as well, it's just, there's so many disincentives for them to step up and pursue these monsters.
Yeah. And, you know, people throw around the term bravery a lot, don't they? You know, it's the word almost has no utility anymore. People use it so much. But with Virginia in particular, to stick your chin out like she did. And I can only imagine, you know, what she was subjected to. And yeah, the circumstances around her death and those events predating her death down in Australia, certainly gives one pause here. And I don't know, does that go to validating, you know, some of these things that she has stated? I can't wait to read the book myself.
Oh, one of the parts that hits me most in the guts is what happens to her from age 7 onwards. She's alleging at the hands of her own father and one of his buddies who are trading daughters to do these things. So it's disgusting. And he's denying all that, but she gives so much detail. It's absolutely sickening. All right, so let me see if there's. We're going to move over to Charlie Kirk. So let me just see if there's any more. Kat wants to know, why were there so many bed sheets?
Exactly. I don't know. I was, you know, that's one of the things that had always confounded me about this, because it's a pile of these things on the floor. I've always, you know, I'm an old soldier. I was in the U.S. Army back when dinosaurs roamed the earth. And, I've often imagined, and maybe this is just Hollywood in my mind, I've often imagined that correctional facilities have this kind of Spartan, you know, because with disorder comes greater disorder, and there's a level of responsibility. And I used the term squalid earlier. The fact that they would allow him to keep this environment in such an unkempt state was fascinating to me. Where would he get all of these materials? And are they a combination of clothing, sheets, bedspreads, pillowcases, all these things? And they're torn to bits, many of them, strips, you know, that sort of thing. I have no idea. And why would they continue? You know, who in their right mind that is in control of someone would continue to peer through the window and look through the little hatch and see the state of repair in there? Not repair, bad usage, but just to see the state of his quarters. It's baffling to me, because there's all manner of things, very dangerous things that can be masked. Because if you're a corrections officer, one of the things that I think, at least, that you want to be sure of is the environment that you might have to step into. And if anything is covered, is hidden, your life is at risk. Your colleagues' lives are at risk. The inmate's life is at risk, or anybody else that might wander into that space. And there are piles of this stuff laying all about, almost like debris. I don't understand it. And I've never been given a satisfactory answer. And I've asked that several times.
Yeah, that's really unusual, because the guards can do cell searches at any moment. Mm-hmm. You are allowed a certain amount of things. Like, it's very restrictive in the, like, one bed sheet and two pairs of boxers, whatever it is. Anything over your allowance is classified as contraband and removed. Now, people do play the system. There was a time where I was housed, the Italian mafia took over, and they were outside smoking. The head was outside smoking with the guards, giving him orders. And he told us when they were going to shake us down and take all our bed sheets. And then he'd have the next shift go and get all their bed sheets back and extra stuff. So there are ways to play the system, but in general, anyone who's got that many bed sheets laying around, someone's going to drop snitch on you or report it, or the guard's going to do a security walk and see it, and they're going to confiscate that. Unless Jeffrey was throwing his money around to feather his nest like that. Who knows? All right, so let us go over to Charlie Kirk then. This is more recent. Epstein's story, you know, from so long ago, but just keeps blowing up in the media. But Charlie Kirk, absolute tragedy, horror that we all saw unfold on TV.
Yes.
All the different videos, all the different angles. So what was your initial perception of that?
I was actually, it was a moment for me. I was actually in the middle of lecture. I was giving a lecture. And if I remember correctly, I was with my underclassmen, sophomore, second year students, my intro to forensics class. And one of the students raised their hand and said, Charlie Kirk has been shot. And I was, you know, we at my university, like many of the universities around there, there's actually a turning point organization on campus. It wasn't very big, but there was one there. People were aware of it. He had never come to my university. My university is a small regional university. but we knew his name. I think many people knew his name. And then he's such a high profile individual that when I heard about it, immediately, as soon as lecture was concluded, I went back to my office and hopped on to see what was out there. And of course, when I hopped on and began to watch some of the videography, I saw the non-digitized versions multiple times. At first, you know, even for me and everything that I've seen over the course of my career, it was shocking. I think the shock was not so much the injury itself as it was where it was done, in a large open public space like that. It's not like this was some kind of clandestine thing where someone, you know, broke into a dwelling and took his life in the middle of the night. This almost felt like message sending. you know what I'm saying? All eyes are on it. You think about everyone that had their phones out, and we still don't know a number relative to that. There had to have been multiple people, hundreds of people perhaps, that were videotaping this. I say videotaping, dates me, doesn't it? That were actually recording this at the time. I think I began to think now, as my brain kind of absorbed this, I began to think, how would you work this case? I've worked very high profile cases. You know, I was part of the team that investigated Olympic Park bombing. You know, I was with the ME in Atlanta, you know, when that occurred. And of course, they're not the same thing, but I've worked, you know, hundreds and hundreds of gunfire related deaths during my career. I saw the injury and I began to think about what position could someone fire this weapon from. And score this kind of shot. I knew that it would have to be probably relatively close, and particularly considering it was such a confined space. This is not a massive, massive area. I knew that they would have to be in a position of elevation. And the configuration of this is like an amphitheater. If you take a look at it, you can see it kind of descends down to the point where Kirk was positioned. So it's almost a fish in the barrel scenario. One thing immediately I was really struck by was the fact the small window the individual had to fire through. And when I say small window, I'm talking about visualizing this position through a scope or even through an iron sight. As it turned out, the weapon that they have, that they retrieved, is a scoped weapon. But the window that you would be looking through to visualize the target, there was a tarp above his head. And then what bordered beneath that, the area of visualization, it was the backs of other people's heads. And so he had to fire through that position in order to strike here. And it's to the left of the midline in the neck. I knew immediately, as soon as I saw the videography, that you had a neuromuscular response. We'll see this many times where if the upper portion of the spinal cord is impacted, the brainstem is certainly the primal brain. You'll see an individual that will actually, you know, clench like this and seize. And I saw that. I can't remember which hand it was that he raised. And I'm sorry, this is so horrible, but that was, you know, my immediate response. I knew that from that second that he had a neuro event. We see this like in American football. You'll see it in rugby where people sustain a head injury and they'll collapse and they'll do this. I knew that is what happened. There was not a huge gush of blood. It looked to me, at least on the videography, that this was more venous blood. It was kind of darker. You didn't have this kind of arterial spraying that was going forth. Not to say that an artery wasn't clipped. And I began in my mind, because I'm thinking about this as a practitioner, I'm thinking, okay, what would you need to do in order to secure the scene? Because it's so vast, in the sense of how many people are there. If you're talking about evidence, you're talking about a lot of stuff that get trampled. And here's the biggest thing. you're going to lose eyewitnesses like that. You're going to have people that are going to be blasting off in every direction of the compass just to get clear. They're traumatized. It's horrific. They're running off. All they want to do is get in their cars and leave. So you've got eyewitnesses that are bolting really quickly to get out of there. It's just a normal human response. I've seen this happen in cases, where people are so terrified that they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to have anything further to do with it. They just want to go off where they're going with their own little piece of this horror story. I knew that was going to be a problem. I don't know how many people they were able to corral to get eyewitness statements. And yeah, I know people will say, well, we've got videography. We do. However, everybody has a different perspective on things. And you want to, again, going back to this idea, of you handle every case like a homicide. You want to get all views of this, things that were seen, things were said, because it's not just about Charlie Kirk. It's about all those people in the periphery. And there's been a lot of speculative stuff that's been put out there. And people pointing to people in the crowds as individuals that are behind him, forward of him, to the sides of him, all that stuff. And yeah, that stuff's important, but all that stuff has to be vetted. And how are you going to get enough teams in there to not just process the scene, but also to canvas the area and ask questions? How are you going to corral these individuals and get them set aside so you can take statements from everybody? So forgive me, I know, but that's kind of how, from my worldview, that's what I was thinking initially. And then I knew that there would have to be an autopsy that would be performed because, and I got in some trouble about this. Let's see what program was, I know what it was. It was on Pierce Morgan's program, where I'm resistant to using the word assassination. And here's why. Because when you start involving politicians in it, and it's a very politicized word, you take the focus off of homicide investigation. Because at its core, just like JFK, this is a homicide investigation. And you work it as a homicide investigation. And shortly thereafter, you had the prosecutor that came out, and forgive me, I can't remember this gentleman's name. But he said, we intend, I think this is after they had effected an arrest. We intend to seek capital punishment in this case. So what does that mean? Well, that means that they're saying that if they convict this guy, they're going to strap him to a chair in Utah and they're going to shoot his ass dead. Okay. Well, that's rather a bold statement, because capital punishment is alive and well in the state of Utah, and they will pursue it. Now, how do you work a homicide? Well, first thing you have to do is an autopsy. And I heard all kinds of ridiculous things floating about, like his body had been spirited away. It really wasn't Charlie Kirk. There was no autopsy performed. And it's plain as the nose on your face. You can go to the state annotated code in Utah. I think it's state annotated code 26.4, I think. Let me make sure I got that right. I know that I had it pulled up, but it's 26-4. In the case of a homicide, autopsies are required on bodies in Utah. And I don't necessarily want to mention anyone's name here, but their initials are Candace Owens, and they're spreading all kinds of nonsense that's out there. At first, I think that it was even her that said he was shot from the rear. And then, she comes back later and says, oh, well, now I'm saying he was shot. He was definitely shot from the front. And then I've got people talking about exploding microphones now. Okay, you've got an exploding microphone. I was on air with, Rob O'Neill, the guy that shot Bin Laden. I think it was on the Pierce Morgan thing. He said, I've shot a lot of people over the course. I've never seen anybody's shirt, open up like this. Well, I got to tell you, I've seen a lot of people that were shot And I know a lot about ballistics, and I can tell you this, that when somebody's shot, there's a projectile that travels through the air. This one in particular, probably about 3,000 feet per second. It's a rather hefty round, kind of on average, 0.30 Imperial caliber. And it's called delivery of kinetic energy. It's like taking a rock and throwing it into a very placid pond. You're going to get this kind of response on a loose fitting t-shirt, you know, and no, there was not a fragmenting, microphone on, you know, and then they'll say, well, it was a directed blast, you know, that drove this thing into his neck and it killed him there on the spot. Okay. Yeah. If that's, that helps you get through the night, go ahead and roll with that. But yeah, there was an autopsy performed because, you know, what kind of fool would think that an autopsy had not been performed? You've got the prosecutor up there that in order to bring this case to trial, can you imagine going before a jury? You've accused this guy. Now you got him on trial and you're going to say, well, judge, you know, doggone it, we forgot to do the autopsy. We don't have the physical proof to talk about the trajectory, the range of fire. Oh, by the way, yeah, we went ahead and buried the body with the, you know, with the round in the body. We're not going to recover that. It is mind-boggling, the click masters that are out there relative to this topic, and it's a real shame. You know, everybody wants to say how sorry they are about his widow and his children, but yet they continue to propagate all this stuff. Let me give you a little insight into this. This is an active homicide investigation. You're not going to get any more information. This is a prosecutable case. Everybody's sitting back saying, oh, well, gee whiz, why don't they release any of the reports? Oh, and then the aforementioned person that had made these comments as well, she said also that, well, they had a brand new coroner. The coroner, yeah, they had a brand new coroner with no experience. The state of Utah hasn't had coroner since 1972. You don't even understand the language. They have a state medical examiner's office. There's not been an elected coroner in Utah since 1972. There's a huge gulf of difference in the U.S. with coroners and medical examiners. Coroners are elected, okay? Medical examiners are appointed, and medical examiners are generally forensic pathologists, board certified forensic pathologists. So to continue down this kind of road of fantasy that everybody is generating, you would have to have the surgeon on board that attended Charlie when he was removed from the scene. He would have to be on board, and he probably didn't know that Charlie Kirk was even in town. Then you would have to have a board certified forensic pathologist and a state medical examiner get on board and put their own careers at risk by refusing to do an autopsy on his remains. And they're also making a big deal out of this idea that, you know, well, it was done during the night. I've participated in autopsies at 3 o'clock in the morning. All right. You do autopsies at all hours. It all depends on the circumstances. And I can tell you something else. If you like that one, more than likely, there were many people in the autopsy suite, and they're not going to say anything at this point. I don't care how much you hoot and you holler and you caterwaul over this thing. They're not going to say anything. So save your words. I mean, I guess you can clickbait the scene, continue on. I had an interesting comment the other day. Somebody said in one of the comments, they said, he obviously works for the Mossad. I'm thinking, am I going to get like a dual pension from them as well? Because I got to tell you, I don't remember signing a contract with the Mossad. It's so inane.
Okay, that's I can see Professor Hamamoto having a chuckle right now because he's in agreement with you on these things. If you've got questions on the Charlie Kirk assassination, viewers, please put them in the live chat now while you've got an opportunity. All right, so JR, they are doing everything possible to obscure this case from the public. Why have the authorities decided to block the public from viewing the proceedings by banning cameras?
That's their choice. That's their choice to have them. I've covered trials in multiple states, all around the country, on both law and crime television and court TV, which you guys have in Great Britain. And in doing so, that's a decision that is made state to state. The feds in the U.S., there are no cameras that are allowed in court. I think that it would be great. I agree with you. I would love to have cameras in the court. I think that it would be absolutely fantastic so that everybody could see everything, so that there is no stone left unturned.
All right. Jet wants to know, why were there no emergency services for such a large gathering?
Yeah, I would think that there would have been. You would have had ambulances standing by. If not for the principal, who would have been Charlie Kirk, you're talking about, depending upon the date, we were right on the cusp of the end of summer. You would think that just with heat related things, you would have an ambulance at least standing by, that there would be somebody there to render aid in the event that somebody got dehydrated or just passed out. I can't explain that.
Susan is wondering, did you find the memorial service odd, and what's your opinion on Erica's behavior?
I didn't watch the memorial service. I was working.
Yeah, and someone who's lost someone like that is traumatized, and they're going to be behaving odd, I imagine. There's a lot of different ways people express trauma and shock. Let's see. Will we know what is going on in the trial? That is my question.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So what happens generally, and I'm speaking from a U.S. perspective, there will be media pool reporters that will be allowed into court when this thing does go to court, go to trial, and they will come out and give comment at court break. And the pool rotates. We've had that happen several times in courts around the U.S. Those pool assignments are changed up periodically. And they'll come out, they'll give a comment, and then the rest of the chirping heads will parrot, what those people are saying from the interior of the court.
Any information on the guys doing hand gestures in the audience? I think we've got one of the guys coming on, but not an audience one who was by Charlie, who was alleged to have made some signal, but it wasn't a signal. I think all the hand gesture stuff's been discredited, hasn't it? You were.
Yeah. Right, I haven't put much stock in that sort of thing.
Why did the college do construction after the Kirk death? Evelyn wants to know.
I don't know. From a crime scene perspective, this was another thing. I've actually had people say that the crime scene was not worked, or that it was worked too hastily. I don't know what their measurement of haste is, what their level of experience is with processing death scenes, these people making these comments. I know that the FBI dispatched evidence response teams to this location. You had the state police that were out there. They would have pulled all of the trajectories pretty quickly. They would have locked it down to the best of their ability, I think, to secure it, and would have taken due course. Particularly, they probably would have used what are referred to as a FARO system, which is a system that we utilize. They used it in the Idaho case. If you guys are familiar with the Idaho homicides at the university, it was used to great effect. It can take thousands and thousands of images pretty quickly, rotating mirrors like this. It spins around. You get all kinds of different perspectives. You can actually go back in and rebuild the crime scene digitally, in addition to static photography that would have been done. Yeah. And I think the biggest thing would have been to either validate or invalidate that the round had passed through. What we're hearing now, at least some snippets, is that the round did not pass through, which I guess if there's one thing to be thankful for, you know, I talked about earlier that there was no one struck in the head forward of Mr. Kirk's position, but also posteriorly, anybody that was back there could have been in the line of fire, if you will. And I've had that happen with high velocity rounds that have passed through bodies and have struck other people, multiple people, as a matter of fact, particularly if they fragment, that does happen. Just so folks understand, with the body there, they will have done, a ton of x-rays, on the remains. You'll have, if this round did in fact fragment, like we're hearing, you're going to see what's referred to as a lead storm within the body. The trick is, did they recover the base of the round? Because they're going to try to do a ballistic match on the round recovered from the remains. And it will be, there will be ammo that will be test fired through this Mauser that they recovered to see if they have a ballistic match on that as well.
So Stanley wants to know, if this occurred within the state of Utah, why is it adjudicated federally?
I don't know. This is a state charge. The feds do not have a homicide charge. Contrary to what people think, this is going to be adjudicated in the state of Utah. Now, if there's some kind of associated federal charges, that might come up, but homicide is a state charge.
All right. We've got some general questions that are coming for you. Have you still got time to do some questions?
Hang around as long as you want.
Oh, thank you. So Danny wants to know, do coroners have to have an MD with a specialization in pathology?
No. Coroners do not in the U.S. Coroners are elected officials, dependent upon what state they're elected in. So I'll give you, for instance, where I started my career was in Louisiana. And by law there, in order to run for the office of coroner, it's an elected position, you have to be an MD, a medical doctor. In other states, there are actually states that require no more than a GED, which is an equivalency test, in order to become coroner. With medical examiners, however, that's why the fact that Charlie's death occurred in Utah, there's a real upside to it from an investigative standpoint. They have a state medical examiner. They don't have coroners, you know, just so Candace understands that. They don't have coroners. The person that administrates the office and all those that work in the office are board certified forensic pathologists. What does that mean? Well, they go to medical school for 4 years after attaining their undergraduate, probably in some kind of science related field, particularly like biochem or chemistry or something like that. They do 4 years of medical school. They'll do 4 or 5 years of pathology residency, which is both clinical and anatomical. They have to pass board certifications. And then beyond that, they do an additional year of forensic fellowship. I worked at an office in Atlanta. We actually had a forensic fellowship program. We would allow in 2 students per year, 1 international student and 1 student from the U.S. It's very rigorous training to have to go through, and then you have to pass that board certification. In the U.S., I think we still have 24 states that have coroners. And it's slowly dying. The system is dying out because of the level of sophistication, I think, that people have now to a great degree. There are fine coroners out there. I've trained them around the country, you know, for many, many years. But just because there are fine coroners doesn't mean that every coroner is the best. There are not great. There are people out there that are practicing forensic pathologists that are not the best out there. However, we understand that, like, for instance, in Utah, the beauty of that system, because it is a state medical examiner, it's not beholden to the state police. It's not beholden to the FBI. That state is actually administrated by the state health department. And as we all know, the number one killer of people in the U.S. is not firearms. It's actually heart disease. And so you have to have somebody that's also is keenly aware of natural disease pathology. And yeah, they also handle any kind of traumatic related death.
Jane's asking about the difference between coroner and medical examiner.
Yeah. So just as I stated, that's the biggest difference. Coroners are in fact elected and medical examiners are appointed. Medical examiners generally have to be at minimum a physician. And in most places they have to be a board certified forensic pathologist.
Brightmore, did the JFK autopsy change after Dr. Baden came to the rescue?
I think I would need to understand what you mean by Dr. Baden coming to the rescue, mm-hmm. because Cyril Wecht is actually the person that handled the charge in JFK. As a matter of fact, Dr. Cyril Wecht, if you get a chance to kind of review some of the stuff that he's talked about, he's, God rest his soul, he just passed on last year. Dr. Wecht was the first person that was allowed to offer an opinion contrary to the Warren Commission at the museum, at the JFK Museum there in Dallas. He was allowed to come in because he didn't believe that there was a single shooter.
Professor Hamamoto has asked, how could expert criminologist Professor Catherine Ramsland mistake confessed mass killer Brian Koberger for one of her more clever students? Are you familiar with this?
Yeah. I know Catherine. Of course, she's a criminologist. She's not a forensic scientist, but we've met at meetings and this sort of thing. Individuals, I think, that just... just because someone commits a horrendous crime does not mean that they're not on paper a brilliant person. As a matter of fact, there are people out there that are pure freaking evil that are really, really bright. Sean, you can probably, you know, you've come across some of these people over the course of your life. I'm sure that, you know, these people are really, really smart, but you wouldn't want to be locked them in a room with them necessarily.
How realistic is body swapping?
I don't know what body swapping is, but are you referring to like saying that this is someone's body and it turns out not to be that person?
Yeah, I think this question is going back to our Epstein conversation.
Well, I don't know nationwide or worldwide. I do know that it's never happened in my little slice of pie. Of course, my little slice is very tiny. It only consisted of New Orleans and Atlanta.
Are you familiar with the Peter Nygaard case?
No, I can't say that I am.
Okay, well, he had an island and he did horrific things to people as well. And this question is like a biology question, I guess. He supposedly ingested the stem cells of terminations of women he impregnated as an elixir of youth.
Mm.
Is there any way to prove this? He is still alive.
Genetic testing, yeah. I would assume if he has falsely impregnated some people, yeah. I would say so, yeah, absolutely.
Hmm. Right, let's see. I think we've got through all of the questions. So, viewers, we've got 2,500 watching live. Let me put the links in again for Joseph Scott Morgan. Please support him on his socials. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion, Joseph?
I would like to say this to you, Sean. I got to tell you, I have followed you for 3 years. And I think we first connected, I think, on LinkedIn. And I don't use LinkedIn at all. It's tedious to me. We did connect that way, and I've been a huge admirer of yours and a tip of the cap to your journey and what you've overcome. I think it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And the fact that you would entertain me and have me here, and that your listeners would sit here and listen to me is great. Thanks. I really appreciate it. And it's an honor to be able to speak with you.
Oh, I really appreciate that, Joseph. And it's been an honor to speak with you as well. And
yeah,
there's something about your voice. It's just really soothing. Your accent.
So you're right now I'm in negotiations trying to get a gig to sell orange juice around the country. You know, maybe I can do that. So
yeah, you
got enough resonance in my voice. You know? I don't know. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, I'm going to let you go and close the show. And huge thank you for spending time with us this evening. You have a great rest of your day.
You're thank quite you, welcome. Joseph. Take care. Yes,
thank you.
Bye-bye, Sean.
Bye-bye. And viewers, thank you for all of your questions as well and helping us shape the interview. I saw there was a question for me about Lady C. And I have just watched this Lady C video today. Let me see, from Stephanie. Lady C made a video saying she had heard from people in 3 or 4 countries who all told her that intelligence, that Ehud Barak had Virginia unalived. And she also added that they'd set it up in a way whereby the media would solely focus on Prince Andrew because they couldn't stop the book coming out. It doesn't have his name in it, but people are going to put it together from the legal filings where she named him. And the media's all been lined up, and deservedly so, to put Andrew on the hot seat. But it's been lined up so that the Ehud Barak story doesn't get mentioned anywhere. And when I turn YouTube on and I'm seeing all the reviews of Virginia's book, it's all Prince Andrew, Prince Andrew, Prince Andrew. No one, I haven't seen anyone talking about Ehud Barak. I think there was a New York Times article, but that was about it. So, yeah, you know, what Lady C, Lauren took offense to what Lady C said about Virginia in earlier videos. Many people took offense, but I think Lady C's spot on in the video that she's put out today, saying she's got inside information that the Mossad whacked Virginia. They had plausible deniability, the way it was made to look. This ties into my theory of pharmacide as well, how they just pharmacize you off, but they grease the Dr. Feelgood with the pills, etc. They grease the palms of the Dr. Feelgood, the quack doctor, with the pharmaceuticals, etc. And the pressure from the black ops is raised on Virginia through the Lady Victoria Herveys of the world, etc. And the pharma's big pharma meds are provided, and then the person does it to themselves. Case closed, folks. So Lady C's, what she said today in that video ties into exactly my theory of pharmacide. But Lady C is putting her finger on who she believes are the perpetrators. So let's see what else we've got coming up. I've got loads more live streams coming up imminently. We're on a roll right now. So the 27th is tomorrow. We've got Wax Unfiltered Live, Jay Slater, What is the Real Story, at 7 p.m. And then on the 29th, Jesse on Fire is back with Charlie Kirk, The Media's Silence Speaks Volumes. 29th also, Kayla Betts, The Charlie Kirk Assassination Theories and Conspiracies. I see Professor Hamamoto was in the chat. Would love to get him on, especially if he's read Virginia's book. And I've also reached out to Lionel this evening as well, asking him if he has read Virginia's book. So Shane's on a roll right now. We're getting loads more guests lined up for the coming days. So please stay tuned. And hopefully we can get Professor H on. Hopefully he's read Virginia's book. I'll